Hello, this is Best Practice, RN Show on Management and Work. I'm Richard Adey. Later in the program, back to school, but not the way you think. It's the return of Jargon Decoder, where we pull apart much of the language at the heart of work and find out what it means. Let's begin with leadership. How good is it in Australian enterprises? The answer is, we don't really know, although you do not have to look too hard to find claims of it being world-class in various companies and sectors. Many years ago, the Canadian writer Mordecai Richler coined the term world-famous in Canada, and there may be a bit of that going on here. Sandy Plunkett has more perspective than most on this. She spent 25 years in the tech sector, both here and in California. She's worked in venture capital, startups, and media. These days, she runs a consultancy on innovation and entrepreneurship, Innovation Clearinghouse, and she's become increasingly concerned about the quality of leadership at the top of many of our businesses.
I think that Australia has had a fairly inward-looking view, almost a self-congratulatory view of itself and its performance in terms of management and management capability on a global scale.
So where are we falling down? What are we not good at that we should be?
I think very key to that is if you view it in the context of global competition and the digital age, I think what we're missing is critical thinking capability. Confident and innovative nations tend to have the ability to hold a mirror up to themselves and to constantly monitor and measure where they're going in the context of regional and global competition and also collaboration. And I think we haven't really done great measurement of leadership. We measure workforce and employees, but we haven't really focused on leadership at the top level since the Carpen Report in 1995.
So if we did a skills audit, perhaps a diversity audit at the very top, what would we find?
Yes, I think one of the keys is to try and define even loosely or broadly what would 21st century management capability look like. We know that it is increasingly tech savvy, and that doesn't mean that everyone has to be a coder, but it does mean a certain degree of digital literacy and especially a degree of savvy about structural changes that have been brought about by the rise of sort of digital technologies and software. The other one is definitely the ability to manage diversity, to identify diversity, seek it out, and manage it. I think that Australia has Australian boardrooms and their C-suites has got a long way to go about that. And it's not just gender diversity, it's of course ethnic diversity as well. And skills diversity. I mean, being able to bring in different specialist technical skills other than just finance and accounting and legal skills, which are in plentiful supply in Australian boardrooms and C-suites today.
So we're talking really about the top end of town. We're talking about the ASX 100 or so here, aren't we?
I think we're talking about the ASX 100, but also our top 100 and top 500, really, but and even sort of government, but also Australia's SMEs, which there has been several different studies over the years about they're between a rock and a hard place, a lot of our SMEs, because they tend to be very debt burdened. A lot of them are owned by family groups, you know, mum and dad and son businesses, and they're quite risk averse. So they're constrained by debt, and that makes them more afraid to reinvest in innovation and take other risks required to get to revamp their businesses. So it's pretty well across the board. And I would even suggest that even in sort of the newer tech startup sector in Australia, which lately we're having quite a resurgence, or for the first time a real go in the tech startup world, there's quite a pipeline of startup companies and would-be entrepreneurs. And I think that's wonderful because innovative nations need that pipeline. But still, even so, we tend to have founders that are still bordering on the naive in context of going after sort of global markets or regional markets. We tend to have what we call me too or imitator companies rather than new to the world initiatives. And why is that important? Because the way startup companies are backed or funded by venture capitalists really, really do look for that global scale ability of startups. So I would suggest that 21st century management capability, problem solving, external orientation, diversity, diversity of skills is across the board.
But it's going to be different in different places, isn't it? So you're just talking about startups, and it is exciting that we are having more of them.
Yes.
But those people are not going to be middle-aged white guys who used to be lawyers and accountants. They are going to be young people who will be, you would think, a bit more tech aware, a bit more culturally aware, and by nature, be risk takers.
Well, that's true to a certain degree, although if you look at some studies about sort of when you're doing a stock take of who are the startups in Australia and who are starting up, the average age of a startup founder in Australia right now, I believe, is about 34 or 35. So it's a little bit older than what you might see in places like Silicon Valley particularly, or places like Israel. So these are people that have tended to work already in large organisations or other institutions or management consultancies. But yes, they will be more technically savvy. But also in the case of startups, whether they're tech savvy or not, they might have a gap in other areas like sort of business problem solving, and they might how to sort of scale into bigger customers, negotiation ability, things like that. So they need to tap into sort of more senior mentorship.
I'm wondering if we have the numbers and the enough experienced mentors for people like that, actually.
In the startup world, access to mentorship that can really, really help them scale globally or regionally is, in fact, very hard to do because it is a scarce resource. Mm. We haven't yet built enough experience and scale in that regard where we've got a ready pool of people that can go and be those mentors to those founders. And so that means they're hard to get, they're hard to keep, and to get them from, you know, from other parts of the world, there needs to be sort of financial incentive in there. So, I mean, it's changing a lot. I mean, right now there's about, I think, 2 million Australian expats living and working overseas in various capacities, in big companies, in several countries. But there are others that are returning. We could do better at tapping those returning expats in a number of different fields and sectors. The challenge for mentorship, though, particularly for startup founders and, you know, 21st century tech-driven or STEM-driven entrepreneurship, whether it's an app company or whether it's a biotech, is really about matching. Just for example, like, oh, I really need to sell into a telco company if I'm a startup. You might make the mistake of thinking that any VP or senior operative of a telco might be a perfect mentor or partner. And that's not necessarily always the case. And part of the problem is mentors that have the experience in big companies often can't really work with the cultural change of working in a startup, which is very, very different because it doesn't have access to the same resources for one.
No,
for
indeed.
One thing.
If we go back to talking about the big end of town,
yes.
What about other countries? Are there, I suppose, senior leadership teams and boards more diverse in terms of skills and expertise than ours?
There is. I mean, I've particularly spent a lot of time in California, which is not necessarily representative of the US. There's certainly more access and more regard for a great diversity of different skill sets, right from sort of social media expertise to science. And if they're not on the board, they're pretty close to it. In Germany, for example, you would find extraordinary strong mix of sort of PhDs and scientists on those boards. Israel's very, very similar in that regard. So we have had a tendency, at least in the last 20, 30 years, to sort of stack our boards, and it served us well to a certain extent. Our focus has been on risk mitigation, financial reporting, all of that is necessary.
Governance,
right.
So that means, really, lawyers and former accountants, doesn't it?
Yes,
They know how to do that.
It really does. And I mean, I remember when I first came back to Australia a few years ago, I was sort of looking into this question of sort of management diversity because I was reintegrating in business and sort of culture generally. I spoke to a number of different people about this, and I had one particular board member say to me that when I suggested that we added diversity of skills to those boards, like, you know, tech skills for one, and his comment was that it would be very dangerous to put non-financially focused people on boards because boards have to sign off on financial statements. Well, my point was that it's not mutually exclusive that you're good at one thing and not good at another. So I thought, I found that quite curious, a comment, and I've heard it many, many times before.
What about engineers, Sandy, the kind of forgotten profession at the top end of town?
Yes.
These are people who are problem solvers. That's what they do.
Yes.
They take scientific understanding and use it to solve problems in the real world. But there aren't many engineers right at the top of Australia.
No, and then that is different to places like Germany and Israel, for example. And so there isn't the engineer. In Australia, though, too, and I've heard this from many other engineers, there is a question of training and diversified sort of education at that sort of the board level for specialists, scientists, engineers that tend to be less people-centric, for example, or whatever. So there is a part that engineers might want to have stuck to their knitting in a way too. So it requires sort of all parties to want it, right?
That is happening. I mean, you're starting to see
specific
management degrees for engineers, so that they can make that transition.
That's right.
And move further up.
That's right. And again, engineering like science, that's a very broad way to sum up a great many different disciplines. And I actually think that it really comes down to, again, if you're trying to get the skills at top board level or indeed at the C-suite level, it really comes down to what company are we? What company do we want to be? Where is our competition coming from? Where are our opportunities, and how? And what skills do we need to go after them?
Boy? But isn't part of the problem that you're identifying that Australia, and I suppose New Zealand too, let's treat it as one market. In many ways, it is. In fact, it's been a bit too cozy. Not in the past, it was protected, but it's still, you know, 27 million people.
Yeah.
And really, what you're talking about is businesses not being internationally competitive because they're doing pretty well with the 27 million people they've got.
That, I mean, we've, what is it, 25 years of uninterrupted growth? You mean, and that's not too shabby, but I do think perhaps that the coziness that you refer to, and I hear that a lot, and I've said that myself quite a lot, is that the duopoly, oligopoly environment in a rapidly changing world that we have now that is technology disrupted, I think that has come at a cost. We have built several layers of management that are great at, you know, financial and governance reporting, but less experienced in terms of that real problem solving the future. And I think that will come home to roost. I think it's also interesting that I really started to look at the sort of do we have 21st century management capability issue a few years ago when I came back to Australia, and only a couple of years ago McKinsey published their Compete to Prosper report. It's a great report, a really interesting report, and it's critical of Australia's competitiveness in companies. In fact, it says outright Australia has a pervasive competitiveness problem. Australian companies are behind on technology uptake, external orientation and learning, and we need to build skills to adapt to change. The very next line in that report, but it was, the good news is Australia has world-class management. And I thought to myself, okay, do we? And the report didn't address that at all. It was just left hanging there, unsupported by the data.
Unusual for McKinsey's,
yes,
too, not to back stuff up.
Absolutely.
All right. So how widely held are the concerns you're raising today within the corporate community?
Not very. I think this is something that's just emerging perhaps now as an issue. There isn't great study done on that, and it's an area that myself and Data 61 are definitely intending to get stuck into some research there. But just very recently, the Centre for Workplace Leadership has done a very, it's quite comprehensive something that hasn't been done since the Carpen Report in 95. So it did a study of Australian leadership. Mm. The results are very, very mixed. They would describe what's called a perception gap between how leaders and managers view themselves and their own performance in anything ranging from sort of customer service to communication skills down the line. There's a perception gap between how well they think they're doing and how well others that they're reporting to them feel they're doing, and indeed whether that perception of that level of performance is being translated to revenue and profit growth. It's quite a comprehensive report, and as I understand it from the Centre for Workplace Leadership, just the beginning, the tip of the iceberg there in terms of what they intend to do.
So we need more research, really, don't we?
We do, we absolutely.
We need to put much better numbers on what you're talking
about. We absolutely need more research, and also it's very, very interesting. I mean, anecdotally, I certainly and others have come across conversations just, you know, on a daily basis or weekly basis in the work that we do, that there is a little pushback at senior levels when you query about these sort of perceptions of their own productivity and effectiveness. It's two things, I think. It's one is like the coziness. It's like, well, we're pretty good here, mate. You know, thanks for the question, but we're pretty okay here. We're doing fine. And another element of it, even if they do see need for change or need for improvement, it is, you know, don't say such a negative story. I mean, you know, this is, you know, we need optimism right now. So, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think that, again, you know, critical thinking and confident cultures can hold a mirror up and improve. And I think that's the point for all of us, really.
Sandy, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Richard.
Sandy Plunkett is the chief executive and founder of Innovation Clearinghouse. What do you think about what she has to say? Get in touch. The homepage is the way to do it. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and look for best practice. And that's what you're listening to now with me, Richard Ady. Remember the days of the old schoolyard? We used to laugh a lot. Oh, don't you remember the days of the old schoolyard? On Best Practice, you'll sometimes hear from people from business schools, and I'm sure we'll talk to people at schools, but today it's more back to school. And in this lesson, we'll consider corporate language more closely. Yes, our jargon decoder, Amanda Woodard, the editor of HRM Online, is back in the studio. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, Richard. Nice to be back.
You wanted to return to the classroom today.
Yes, I did, because so much of that language from the classroom has seeped into this strange closeted world of business jargon. And some of the same ideas inhabit both worlds, you know, where the teacher-pupil relationship, where the teacher wants to empower their pupils, so businesses want to empower their staff. And that word is freely bandied about. In fact, Forbes' article called it empowering the most condescending transitive verb ever. And it's really kind of, they talked about what someone above your pay grade does when they'd like you to do a job that sounds really important, but in fact is a bit of a dog's body job, really. And it's probably a complete pain. And it implies that you're capable of doing a little but of this difficult task, but at the end of the day, remember it's still them who's in charge.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned the whole teacher-pupil relationship, because I was thinking about this. We can all remember the great teachers in our lives. We can remember the bad ones too. It's the same for bosses.
It is. And there's another strange kind of phenomena that's taken place with the words learning and lessons.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is one of my bete noires. So learnings, how can we even say that?
Yeah, it's kind of hated use of the verb as a noun, isn't it? And, you know, my theory about it is that the word lesson is so hated by some people who kind of flunked school and who were probably bullied by all that, those little petty humiliations from their English teacher, that the very word lesson now kind of summons up all those horrors. So rather than use that, we've come to start using learnings in an office environment, which it's kind of part of that sort of new age mumbo jumbo, like teachings and learnings. It has this kind of transcendental, almost kind of mystical connotation. And it also indicates, of course, that lessons are ongoing. ongoing and continuous. And that's what businesses want. You know, that's what business preaches, that we have to keep learning new stuff to keep pace with that kind of fast changing business environment.
I don't mind lessons. I do dislike learnings intensely, I have to say. Anything else from English class?
Yes, period one, English. Probably the word impact, I think. This is kind of a wannabe verb that's come about, and a lot of people think it's come about because people don't really understand the difference between the words affect and effect. And rather than kind of mixing them up and making themselves appear foolish, then they will use the word impact in, for example, we will impact our competitors' sales, or we will impact our customers. And that's a much safer bet than trying to decide whether you should use affect and effect. So I suggest anyone who doesn't know the difference probably goes and looks that up after this show.
I think it would be definitely better. What about everyone's favourite subject, he says, slightly tongue-in-cheek, and that is maths.
Ah, well, maths. You see, maths is business's favourite subject, because this is all about the kind of the numbers and the analytics and the data, and this is the bottom line. So this is where business feels very safe and secure in the maths lesson. It's probably sitting at the front. But, you know, the good thing about maths is that you can also be very creative with maths, and that's what business jargon has done. I mean, one of the most crazy phrases is all about effort, giving that 110%. I've heard that in so many meetings. But, you know, the good thing about effort in terms of how you measure it, it's that when you give your all, it is 100% and nothing more and nothing less than that. So saying that you're kind of looking for 110% probably just means that you flunked maths in primary school.
You hear it all the time. You hear it in sport a lot, and you hear it, and we have talked briefly about sport before, but you do hear it in management speak. And I, every time I hear it, I keep thinking, but it's not possible.
No, it's not. But the other area of kind of hard facts as well, I think, is science.
And so, yes, I was a bit of a science nerd at school.
Were you?
Yes,
yeah,
I was.
That doesn't surprise me, Richard, actually. Science, again, is a safe territory for business. It loves kind of adopting some of the words from science, because science is all about proof and authenticity, and business loves that kind of alignment with science words. So you have things like phrases like lots of moving parts, which basically just means something's really complex. Mm. And, you know, you can think of things that have lots of moving parts and think, do you really want your business to be like that? Pinball machines, they have lots of moving parts and they're very buzzy and clanky and noisy. But I'm not sure I'd want my business to operate like a pinball machine.
Ecosystem. What about that? That's something that business loves.
Yeah, we're into the softer sciences now, the biology, aren't we, and the ecology. Yes, businesses often talk about their ecosystems now when they're referring to their entire business. And the thing about this is, unless you're working in hydrology or water purification systems, it's really doubtful that you are part of any kind of ecosystem. But eco, you attach eco to anything, and you immediately think green and kind to the planet. So that's a great thing for businesses to kind of associate with, and it's highly unlikely that your business is being genuinely kind to the planet, but the association is there nevertheless.
What about robust, Amanda? Is that coming from the same kind of area?
Yeah, robust is scientific proof and evidence-backed. And I often find that word used, if you go along to business conferences, quite often you'll hear the stage speakers talking about robust evidence, and then very rarely do they go on to back it up with any scientific figures. But
it's they like the word.
They like the word very much.
Any more from science, or are there any from woodwork?
Not yet, but, you know, you feel it's coming, don't you?
I date myself, I think, when I say woodwork. I don't know.
I think it's called industrial technology these days, isn't it?
I hope there are none from the schoolyard, because certainly in my day they were still a bit violent. I don't think it's quite like that now.
No, not quite like that.
Was that the bell, Amanda?
I think it was, Richard. I think you can remove your tie now and run for the school gates.
Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Amanda Woodard is the editor of HRM Online, the magazine of the Australian Human Resources Institute. And that's it for this week.
Best Practice is produced by Moira Tadias. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Ady.